The first case on our calendar is 03-1766, State of Ohio versus Robert Bethel. Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. At this time, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal time. May it please the court, on behalf of Mr. Bethel this morning, I'm going to try to address, if time permits me, three groups of issues. The first group I want to address are the issues surrounding the due process violations stemming from the prosecutorial drafted plea offer and plea agreement letter. The second group of issues I'd like to address is the First and Sixth Amendment violations that resulted from the trial court's closing of the courtroom during the Rule 11, partial Rule 11 proceedings, and the structural error that occurred there. And if time permits, the First Amendment violations that resulted as a result of the trial court admitting prejudicial, irrelevant, and inflammatory gang affiliation evidence. With respect to the issues surrounding the plea offer and the plea agreement, this is somewhat unlike any of the other cases that I was able to find in researching the cases that the state cited. I don't think there are any that address the fact pattern you have before you. Specifically, at approximately 10:30 on the day of the plea, there was a proffer letter that was provided by the prosecutor to the defense through his counsel, signed by defense counsel and Mr. Bethel. In that letter, it indicates that no statements made or information provided by the client during the off-the-record proffer discussion will be used against the client in any criminal case. It's very clear that was at approximately 10:30 in the morning, 10:25, the record will show you. At approximately 12:25, Mr. Bethel's brought to the trial courtroom, where the courtroom is open but is not done on the record at first, and is provided the plea agreement letter. The first proffer letter is Defendant's Exhibit 2 that you'll find in the record. The plea agreement letter you'll find is Defendant's Exhibit 3 in the record. When Mr. Bethel and his counsel arrived in the courtroom, they were provided a typewritten document captioned with the case information that had two very conflicting paragraphs. Specifically, paragraph 1 indicates that, pursuant to this agreement, the proffer taken on this date, August 30th, earlier in the day, would be admissible in a criminal trial against the defendant in the event the defendant does not abide by the terms and conditions of the agreement. But if you look at paragraph 6, midway down, after basically in the first part of paragraph 6, outlining what is very common, that the prosecutor's office has the sole discretion to determine if the plea has been complied with, if the conditions have been satisfied, and only the prosecutor's office can make that decision. There's a line that indicates the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office may declare this agreement null and void. The Franklin County Prosecutor's Office may then automatically reinstate the original charges against the defendant, as well as file any additional charges. Further down, however, it says, in the event this agreement becomes null and void, the parties will be returned to the position they were in before this agreement. That language seems to directly contradict what we had already seen earlier in that morning, that Mr. Bethel was told, promised, and signed off on in the proffer letter, that anything he said would not be used against him. That said, the case law, I think, is pretty clear under Santabello that plea agreements are basically a contractual device, and because of the constitutional concerns and implications, are to be strictly construed against the state. We see similar provisions of strict construction against the state in the revised code, for example. The problem you have is interpreting the plea offer letter and this agreement together. The second problem that you have is, however you resolve this particular issue, there are evidentiary problems that stem from that under Evidence Rule 410. If, for example, you would rule that the statements of the proffer would be admissible, that is one interpretation. However, the fact that there was a plea, withdrawal of the plea, and the reason that the plea was withdrawn still would not be admissible under Evidence Rule 410, and they were admitted improperly. When you look at the language, the prosecutor gave himself several options, I think. And I think it's telling that the trial court considered and characterized this plea agreement as inarticulately drafted. When you look at the briefing that you have from me and from the state, there's a lot of space, literally in pages and paragraphs, devoted to explaining what this agreement meant. I think that at some level demonstrates the ambiguity that's in here. If there is ambiguity, strictly construing this against the state, I think the worst case for the defendant is that the agreement is null and void. It's like it never existed. Therefore, going back to the condition in the state of the parties before that agreement would put him with the terms of the proffer letter of 10:30 that morning, where any statement he made could not and would not be used against him. There are options available, however, and the prosecutor chose its poison, so to speak, in having the agreement nullified. I think if you read paragraphs 7, 8, and 9 together, there is the option that is what apparently the prosecution started out to pursue. Once there was some indication, and there's a debate factually in the record, I think, of if Mr. Bethel actually was called to testify and then refused, or prior to that, through his counsel, indicated he would not testify. And I think that's a factual discrepancy that you'll have to resolve. My recollection of the record and review of it is he was never called to testify. So it's a presumptive breach at best. However, if you look at 7, 8, 9, it allows the prosecutors, without any other recourse, to withdraw the plea and reinstate the charges.
But this plea was withdrawn because he refused to testify against Chavez. Wasn't that the fact?
That is the point I was trying to make. Factually, my indication and my recall of the record and the citation in the brief that you have is he was never called to testify. The Chavez
may not have been called in court or issued a subpoena, but the fact is the state entered into a plea negotiation with him for one reason or another, based presumably in part on his agreement to testify in another proceeding. And
agreed.
Then when he refused to do that, then the state said, all right, if you don't want to do that, we're not going forward with the agreement. And that's what happened, isn't it?
I agree with you factually that generally that is what happened. At some point, there was an indication he would not testify.
All right.
The state then filed a motion and asked the trial court to withdraw the plea, which the trial court did.
Yes.
I submit to the court that had it stopped there, these issues would not be before you. Because had they simply withdrawn the plea, the parties at that point would be faced with the procedural situation of the plea's withdrawn, the original indictment not having been dismissed yet because Mr. Bethel's not been sentenced, is in effect reinstated, and he's free to go to trial. And under the terms of paragraph 1, I think his proffer statement probably could have been used against him. But the prosecutors didn't stop with that. They pursued it farther and filed a motion to ask the court to have the entire agreement nullified. Once they did that, they chose an additional remedy that was available to them under the agreement that basically made the agreement a non-factor then. And as a result, the parties are returned, and I think the prosecutor in the record specifically says, in the event that Mr. Bethel decides not to cooperate or decides not to testify, we start from the very beginning. And there's a specific quote in that proceeding where that's the message conveyed by the prosecutor to Mr. Bethel, the court, and defense counsel. That being the case, the position they were in before that happened was the proffer letter, where nothing said in the proffer could be used against him. And I think that's where the factual scenario that you will have to resolve somehow is different than almost any of the cases that you have before you that I've submitted or that the state has submitted. And that is because when you look at the cases that discuss plea agreements, they're in effect fact-specific because most agreements are drafted as needed on an as-needed basis. And whatever remedies are put in a particular agreement may not apply or be appropriate for the facts you have before you.
Weren't the proffer letter and the agreement bundled together, so to speak?
I say yes. And I think if you read the proffer letter, if you read it independently as a contract, Mr. Bethel proffers in exchange for which nothing he says will be used against him. There's a Castigar provision allowing the state to make derivative use. That was done and satisfied. It was after that contract, in effect, had been completed that you now have the new situation of putting a plea agreement in front of Mr. Bethel that says, oh, wait a minute, everything you told us in the proffer can be used against you. And I realize that there is significant case law, and I understand the reason for it, that allows prosecutors to have remedies like using a proffer against the defendant to help give some bite to the agreement, if you will. So the prosecutor has some leverage to further ensure the defendant's compliance. But in this case, they went a step farther by not stopping with having the plea withdrawn and set aside, but then having the entire agreement nullified. And then that gets you back to the bundled concept of the agreements that Once that's gone, you're left with the proffer letter, which says it cannot be used. I think there's an additional problem.
Well, counsel, the help us understand the proffer letter was executed in an effort to get the plea agreement, was it not?
It's not clear on the record, but logically, yes, obviously it would be. In fact, the first paragraph of the letter indicates, pursuant to our earlier discussions, we're interested in meeting with our investigators for the purpose of trying to resolve the case. So in effect, that's the language, correct?
And so as Justice Lanzinger indicated, isn't that all woven together? It was, we'll do this and the prosecutor will fill in the blanks in their standard plea agreement, and some time lapsed. I mean, if this had all been worked out the day before, those documents would have all probably been laid down and signed together, or it might have been merged into one document.
I agree 100% with what you're saying, and that is why I think there's a problem. Because the situation is it was bundled. If you look at the proffer letter that says no statement made or information provided during the proffer will be used against the client, reading that compared to paragraph one in the plea agreement, anything you say will be admissible in a criminal trial against the defendant, it directly contradicts. And so by putting them together, it is an inherent contradiction. And I think that's where the trial court lapsed also in conducting the Rule 11 proceedings by not completely going through the plea agreement. And when you read the record again, and if I can focus your attention, you'll see that while she does address paragraph one, she never addresses paragraph six and the ambiguity that's created. And there's never, I'm sorry?
You could also look, though, at the proffer as like pre-contract negotiations. The proffer is the offer, here's what we're willing to do. And then once you have the plea agreement, the offer itself is gone because the plea agreement then represents what the parties agreed to, and the parties agreed if you don't testify, the statement will be used against you. The null and void can be interpreted just to refer to the fact that the plea is off the table now. It's just step two. Step one is, you know, the hammer, if you don't testify and you've agreed to this, we can use this statement against them. And you can interpret the proffer letter simply as pre-contract negotiations.
In general, I would agree with you, but I think when you look at the case law that requires these types of agreements to be interpreted as a contract, strictly construed against the state, that's the ambiguity. I think that the very essence.
But the first statement, the proffer, goes away once you solidify the terms that the parties agreed to in the plea agreement. All the negotiations beforehand go away as a relevant factor because now you have the contract itself, which the agreement embodies.
I think in general you could do that, but with all due respect on these facts, I disagree, and here's why. If you do that on these facts, then the state has basically made a proffer, set up a terms of the proffer with, you proffer to us, we won't use anything against you. Aha, now that we've got your proffer, we're going to change the rules. And in that position, the defendant is more or less left to unring that bell. He's now proffered and confronted with, well, gee, I proffered. If I don't enter a plea agreement and I proceed to trial, they have this proffer. If I testify and there's any inconsistencies, it can be used against me. Or I have to, now I'm more or less forced or coerced in a very subtle way, obviously not directly, to enter into the plea agreement. But now when I enter into the plea agreement, they can use my proffer against me.
But if he had rejected the proffer, if he had said no, then that would have been the only contract out there. That would have been the only thing out there. And it would have clearly said you can't use the proffer against him. Once he goes to stage two and signs a plea agreement, the proffer goes away as it's just pre-contract negotiations.
I agree with you, but if you accept my interpretation of the nullification of the contract and the prosecutor's representation during the Rule 11 colloquy, that if it's nullified, the parties are returned to the position like this agreement never existed, you're back then with the proffer letter.
Well, you have to, I guess then we really have to look at what does null and void apply to. Does it only nullify the fact that the plea's withdrawn, the original statement's in, or does it totally throw the contract out? And that seems to be your position. You're claiming that null and void means the contract never existed versus null and void means the plea itself is only vacated, but the terms of the contract survive.
I agree with you. And I will address an issue that is in the state's brief where there is some case law they cite that addresses the definition of rescission. A plea agreement was rescinded for whatever reason. And I think it does come down to the definition, and I realize the label you put on the act of whatever you did to this plea agreement is not necessarily controlling, but I think when you look at the understanding of the parties at the time and during the Rule 11 proceeding where the prosecutor says, if you don't testify or you change your mind, we go back to like this never existed. And I think that gets into the strict construction, the meeting of the minds, because it is a contract, and the ambiguity. So I agree with you that that is what you will have to decide in some form or another, however you decide to label it. I think there's another issue, however, that if the court wants to avoid having to define null and void, you can look at the improper closing of the courtroom, because it was during the closing of the courtroom where the plea agreement was discussed, and only part of the plea agreement. And that was at the proceeding, I think it was at 12:25 that day, August 30th. Later that afternoon, the parties all came back and entered the formal, what we would see as the actual plea form, where it indicates the charges and what the amendments were and the admission as to the offenses. But the discussion with the court about the terms and substance of the underlying agreement was not done in open court. Now, I realized that
But the court held a hearing, and the attorneys testified that they told him if he agreed with the plea agreement and then backed out of it, the proffer was going to be used against him. They testified to that, didn't they?
If you read the entire substance of it, they also testified that they had no recollection of discussing paragraph 6 with him, which is what I'm trying to tie in with the closed proceedings and the Rule 11, is that if you discuss part of the plea agreement with the defendant, in this case Mr. Bethel, about paragraph 1, but you don't discuss paragraph 6 and he reads paragraph 6, he's going to gain some measure of knowledge from reading the entire agreement.
But the trial court conducted a hearing, listened to the evidence, and made a determination about it.
The trial court did. You're correct. Later, I think it was basically styled as a motion to suppress. But I think what is apparent in that is the trial court during that hearing referred to the proceeding where the plea agreement was discussed as an open court proceeding. And I think it's a structural error to conduct that type of inquiry, that portion of the Rule 11 proceeding, with a closed courtroom. When you look at the facts that were put in the record about why the courtroom was closed and locked, there are none. There's no finding made of the necessity to close the courtroom. There's no finding as to who requested it, if anybody, or if it was done sua sponte. And there's nothing in the record that will provide this court with any way to apply the test that you're all familiar with about the closing of a courtroom. I believe it's in Georgia versus Waller. And I think this court in Perry, I believe, has said that a public and open courtroom, that deprivation of an open and public courtroom is a structural error.
However, your client did not object to the closed hearing. And was there any prejudice after the hearing? The motion to withdraw the plea was granted.
I think there was a very obvious prejudice. I think that first, if you assume that an open and public hearing is for the adjudicative portion of a proceeding, a motion to suppress, as the case law says, and so on, an essence of adjudicating somebody's guilt would be a plea. So during the plea colloquy, where this plea agreement that we see has ambiguities in it was discussed only in part, there is a possibility that had the court been open, that omission to discuss the entirety of the plea agreement might have been called to her attention. I think when you're discussing the type of plea and the type of case that is here, a death penalty case, closing the courtroom during a plea hearing, I don't know anything else that comes as close to being structural in an error as that.
But when you look at the reasons for the closure, I mean, here he was, the allegation was that a witness in a gang case had been killed. And now you've got another witness, potentially, agreeing to testify against other gang members. And the attorneys wanted the closure to protect their own client from other gang members possibly finding out he was going to turn state's evidence. Isn't that for his own protection? Where's the prejudice to him? He was protected by this closure, which later became an open record.
Well, with all due respect, I have to disagree with you. His attorneys did not ask. I can find nowhere in the record where the defendant, the defense counsel, any of them, because there were several defense attorneys here, requested the court to close the proceedings. And when you look at the case law...
Nor there is an objection then, so you can imply consent from the fact they didn't object.
I would agree with that, but I think there's a distinction between this set of facts, and I think it's Cassano, if I'm pronouncing it right, that this court decided, C-A-S-S-A-N-O, where in that case, the defense counsel did request the closure of the court because I think there were four or five witnesses that would testify and they didn't want harm and to protect people. In this case, you don't have a defendant affirmatively seeking the closure, and I don't find anywhere in the research that I was able to complete that the defendant has to affirmatively object to it. And I think the fact that it is a structural error,
The court has the right to determine whether the court should be open or closed, and it certainly would be, since the defendant didn't ask for it to be closed, he certainly should have objected.
If you think
his attorney should have objected.
I would agree that maybe should have been there, and perhaps when you address the ineffective assistance of counsel assignment, that would be a point that you could address there. However, there's also a benefit to the prosecutor, if you will, if you think through the reason for closing this. They didn't want anybody to find out about the plea agreement because they didn't want some harm to come to somebody else. But that's not what the case law allows this court to look at. But most importantly, and I don't know how to stress this enough, there's nothing in the record as to why it was closed. Everything that we've talked about are merely inferences, that it was allegedly a gang member protecting another gang member at trial and so on. But there's nothing in the record. And the case law is very clear that there has to be specific findings and specific facts so that a reviewing court such as this one can decide if it was an abuse of discretion or was properly closed. I agree that the trial court had the discretion to close that. I'm not saying she didn't. But I think that the way she went about it.
But she should have made a record.
Exactly. And I remember about the second day of law school, they told me, you're going to lose a lot, but make your record because that's the only chance you have. Maybe there should have been a defense objection. I don't disagree with that. But because it's a structural error, I don't think that's necessarily going to be guiding your ultimate decision on it as it relates to that particular
point. Structural error, as you know, is very difficult to show. And there's a test, and one of the elements of the test is that the error is so egregious that it would cause one to question the judicial process. I mean, it goes to the fundamental elements of the judicial process. Here he withdrew his plea and then was tried by a jury and was found guilty. Wouldn't it more likely be structural error in this instance if he had not withdrawn his plea and would cause one to wonder what happened in the suppression hearing that was closed?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Perplexed. I don't think I must not have stated my question clearly.
Can you maybe try again?
Well, the structural, where do I need to start? The structural error, you didn't cite the test for structural error, which is we've written on it.
Right.
U.S. Supreme Court's written on it, of course, a number of times. And the showing has to be that the error, there was no objection, that the error goes beyond plain error. It goes to the very fundamental principles of the justice system, that the error is such that it would cause someone, objective observer, to believe that something is wrong here with the process. Is that, argue that to me. Why is structural error an element here, a consideration?
I think it's an element first because the United States Supreme Court in Waller versus Georgia said an open and public trial is a structural error.
Denial and Waller error. Said not a new trial, but a new hearing.
Therein is I think, as I pointed out in a brief, the situation is you have a unique procedural situation here where if you order a new hearing, it really doesn't remedy the structural defect. The best you could do, I think, is order a new trial where anything that happened during that proceeding could not be used by either party, one way or the other.
But, Counselor, the defendant prevailed at the hearing, was allowed to withdraw the plea, so the presumption is that there was no prejudice to the defendant here, no matter what the reason for the closure of the courtroom, and the intimation is that it was done for the protection of information that, if released at that point in time, could have compromised the safety of the defendant or those close to the defendant in the community. And let's face it, we were dealing with some pretty aggressive gang behavior here. And there's no denial that this is a gang-related crime. So if you have no harm to the victim, the prevailing of the victim at the hearing, how can you say that there is a presumption of structural error that is going to necessitate a duplication of that hearing at some point?
I think I may have not explained it clearly in the brief. The defendant did not ask to withdraw his plea. It was not done by the defendant. The state filed a motion requesting trial court to have the plea set aside. The plea that was set aside was a plea that was entered in part during a closed proceeding. So the defendant didn't get the protection of having an open and public hearing where a plea that he entered was later taken away from him without him requesting it be taken away. I don't know if that answered
his
portion.
His failure to testify, in essence, is a reluctance to cooperate pursuant to the agreement is a withdrawal of the plea.
Well, that gets to the remedy provision that the state sought. But where the prejudice occurred was when the plea was originally taken. It wasn't done in an open forum, and it wasn't done completely. All the terms and conditions of the plea were not discussed. And I think that's the second half of that closed proceeding issue that is so important. The trial court never addressed paragraph 6 and the ambiguities and the conflicts that are created by that. I have about 3.5 minutes left, but I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
Mr. Tremulin.
May it please the court, my name is Dick Tremulin. I represent the state of Ohio in this case. It is our position that the trial was conducted properly and that the sentence is appropriate. If I may, I'd like to go directly to the open court arguments. I believe those are propositions 3 and 5 in the briefs. Because I'd like to point out that on page 17 of our brief, when I quote State XRL Dayton newspapers, I should have made it clear that I was quoting a dissenting opinion. I think as the court reviews that, the court will realize that that does not take away from our argument regarding the open court. However, I wanted the court to be aware that my quotes of State XRL Dayton newspapers are to a dissenting opinion. It is somewhat attenuated to suggest that a courtroom that was partially closed for part of a criminal Rule 11 inquiry with no defense objection can rise to the level of plain error. And it's attenuated because eventually that guilty plea was withdrawn.
Mr. Tremulin, why do you say it was partially closed?
Well, the record indicates very clearly that it was closed with the agreement of the parties, and the court said, well, it closed with the agreement of the parties, and also the court indicated only those persons with an active interest in this case are going to be inside these locked doors. The defendant's mother was there, an attorney she had hired on her behalf to act as something of an intermediary between the appointed counsel and herself was there. Obviously, the other parties were there too. So it wasn't closed to everyone. It was closed to the media or people who just happened to be passersby. So that's why I say it was partially closed. And it was
is there
only
any explanation anywhere that you are aware of as to the purpose for this on the record?
Well, the only hint, there's obviously a hint that goes through this entire transcript.
Well, we know that the Crips and the folks are involved. We understand that.
Detective Calais, when he was being when he was testifying in volume 11 at page 200, indicated that at this time, at the time of the plea negotiations, there was a significant concern for the defendant's safety. And if you just take the judge's words for what was going on at the time, by the way, the criminal rule 11 dialogue, that was an open courtroom. The only thing that was partially closed was that the judge said, I understand there's been an agreement reached. Would you please go over it with me? And in fact, she starts the whole thing by saying, it's my understanding from everyone in the back, it is your intention to go over this defendant, the agreement that's been reached, and we have all these doors locked. It's my further understanding, and I think she's referring to from all of the parties, that the agreement will be placed under seal. Clearly, if you're going to be placing the agreement under seal by agreement, it doesn't do any good to also have an open courtroom and allow media, interested bystanders, or people with a bad intent walk through. So it's my take on this is that the court refers to an agreement that had happened between the parties.
Does the agreement then permit the trial judge to waive the requirements of Waller? Waller has specific points that the trial judge is required to follow in closing a courtroom.
Now, that's obviously, I agree with the court. Clearly,
she didn't do that. I mean, it's not in the record if she did.
There's nothing on the record.
I assume she didn't do it.
The record does not reflect the court went through the appropriate guidelines for when a court can be closed. Although it's clear that she could have. It's our position that this doesn't rise to plain error. And I'm looking at two cases from this court, Bayless and Cassano. In that case, Cassano, this court found that a closing of a suppression hearing at a defense request was an error. But it was an invited error, and it didn't affect the fairness or the integrity or the public reputation of the trial. You take that hand in hand with Bayless. Bayless said that a closure for the benefit of the defendant and with the consent of the defendant comes very close, in this court's words, to being a defense motion itself. This court in Bayless said any error about a closure of a courtroom in that case has effectively been waived by the lack of an objection. So Bayless and Cassano are the primary cases that I'm referring to with regard to the open court case. I don't think that this is a structural error. I think another aspect of the structural error guidelines is simply that in some circumstances, prejudice is to be presumed from a preserved error. It's my understanding there was no error because there was no preservation of the error in this case. This doesn't rise to the level of a plain error. This is very, very similar to what happened in the State versus Spivey case, in another case from this court. In that case, the terms of the plea agreement were gone over in chambers. This court found that to be a violation of Criminal Rule 11, but a technical violation. And this court found that there was no prejudice that could be found in that case. The ultimate concern here is whether the courtroom proceedings, whether the integrity of the courtroom proceedings was marred. And the integrity of the courtroom proceedings was not marred. The Criminal Rule 11 inquiry was done in open court. The appellant indicates that it's his understanding that the proffer letter was passed between the parties that very morning. I don't find that in the record, and I don't know that to be true. But I think what is clear is that we can go on to talk about the plea agreement in this case. There are two different documents in this case. The appellant has clearly stated that and appropriately stated that. Defendant's Exhibit 2 is a proffer letter. It's undated. Defendant's Exhibit 3 is a plea agreement. It is dated. It's signed by all the parties. By its terms in paragraph 10, it is a comprehensive document. It indicates that it embodies all of the agreement in this case. by that, this court can clearly conclude that the preliminary document is no longer the agreement of the parties. And the order that these things happen in is this. A proffer letter was passed and discussed between the counsel in this case. The defendant sat and gave a proffered statement. The court's got the benefit of that. It states Exhibit T2, and it's transcribed. In fact, it was played to the jury during Detective Calais' testimony. At any rate, then the defendant was given the opportunity to make a plea agreement. At that point, the defendant could have not made the plea agreement. He did. The defendant signed it. And what the state wants the court to remember is what the defendant has told us about his intention. He entered this agreement by fraud. He acknowledged that he never had any intention of abiding by the terms of the plea agreement. When a court considers the contractual plea agreement cases that we've cited, the court has to bear in mind that one of the parties to this agreement was entering it by fraud. The state of Ohio could very well have been left without sufficient proof as against the co-defendant. One of the questions that was asked by the court is this: was Robert Bethel actually called to testify in the Jeremy Chavis case? The record is pretty clear in this case that the prosecutors talked to, at that point, witness Robert Bethel immediately before the Chavis case was going to start. And they indicated, they came back to, apparently Bethel said, look, I have no intention of testifying in this case that's about ready to start. They brought that again before Bethel's trial judge, and they said, it's our position that this agreement should be null and void. The plea agreement is off. The court agreed. The court didn't just take the prosecutor's word for it. The court said, is that true, Mr. Bethel? And he said, in so many words, maybe in these exact words, I have no intention of testifying in the trial that's getting ready to start upstairs. It would have been an ethical violation for the prosecutors in the Chavis case to have presented a witness to the court that they knew was not going to testify. So I don't believe it's significant to considering Bethel's repudiation of his own agreement whether Bethel actually got called and sworn in the Chavis case. He indicated that he had no intention of fulfilling his obligations and that he would not testify. At that point, he repudiated. The court looked into this at a motion to suppress. It was styled a motion to suppress, also a motion in limine, with regard to whether the state of Ohio in the Robert Bethel case would be entitled to use the proffered statement of Robert Bethel, as paragraph 1 of the plea agreement says it can. The court inquired of defense counsel. By now, of course, we had a new set of defense counsel. The court inquired of the previous counsel who had signed on the plea agreement whether it was their opinion that Robert Bethel understood that his proffered statement was going to be used against him if he chose to not testify in the Chavis case. It couldn't be more clear. One of the attorneys testified that paragraph 1 of the plea agreement, and that's the paragraph that says your statement can be used against you if you choose to repudiate. Bethel brought that to the attention of his attorney. He asked what it was all about. He refused to sign it until his attorney had a chance to go talk to the prosecutor and see if it was negotiable. Determined it wasn't, and Bethel signed it anyway. the counsel indicated they had 30 or 45 minutes to go over this plea agreement with Robert Bethel. At that point, I think the appellant and I diverge. Had Bethel chosen to not sign the plea agreement, having made the proffer, then at that point he would have been bound by the terms of the proffer letter. Because obviously, Defendant's Exhibit 3 hadn't yet been signed. But he chose to sign it, and for good reason. He acknowledged that he was playing the game here. He was betting against the notion that he'd ever have to testify. And it's pretty clear. If Jeremy Chavis had entered a guilty plea, or his trial had ended in some fashion shy of a trial, he never would have been called on to pull his weight here. I believe we did find some cases that are very similar. U.S. versus Scruggs is a case from last year out of the Fourth Circuit. It was very similar to this case in that there was a plea agreement breached by the defendant. There was two provisions in the plea agreement that were very similar to what's going on here. One is that the plea agreement would be null and void in the event of a breach. The other is the remedy provision. In the event of a breach, the defendant's statements could be used against him in the state's case in chief. In U.S. versus Scruggs, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Fourth Circuit said that is appropriate. That does not violate due process. It doesn't violate double jeopardy. Just a moment, please. Appellant argues that paragraph one of the plea agreement never had any meaning, that it was redundant from the start. And that's the argument he puts forward in his brief. It's our position that when parties into a contract, they don't intend for any of the parts of the contract to be meaningless. And in fact, paragraph one said, in no uncertain terms, if you breach this agreement, your statements are going to be used against you in your your statements are going to be used against you in your own trial. I think there's a red herring that the appellant entered into this when he testified at his suppression hearing. The appellant said, sure, I did this, and in fact, I acknowledge I did it by fraud. I never had any intention of doing this, but I had an ulterior motive. I wanted to get a continuance of my trial date. I think that's a red herring that has been inserted into this by the appellant at his suppression hearing. And I'll say why. When the defendant, the appellant, was brought before his own trial judge and asked, well, look, is it true that you're not going to testify against the fellow who's starting trial upstairs? He said, no, I have no intention of doing that. There was nothing about a continuance then. That didn't last very long. But what did go on for a lengthy period of time was the suppression hearing. Bethel's attorneys at the time testified. Bethel testified. Throughout the entire suppression hearing, that is, suppression hearing / motion in limine, is the state going to be allowed to use your statement against you? There was nothing about a continuance. Nothing about a continuance at the time he signed the plea agreement. Nothing about it at the time he did a proffer letter. This shows up much later in the game. The only person that adds it is the appellant. And I believe the first time it's mentioned at all is when the appellant testified in his own behalf at trial. I think a reasonable understanding of what the parties intended by the plea agreement is that the parties intended that this obligated the state to drop the death specs on Robert Bethel. It obligated the defendant to testify against his co-defendant. And as a remedy provision, it allowed the state to use his Robert Bethel statements against him in their case in chief.
Counsel, what was the impact of this defendant's breach of the plea agreement? What was the impact of this defendant's breach of the plea agreement, if any?
Well, you mean in the Chavis case?
Yes.
Okay. That's difficult to say, but it's very clear that Chavis got convicted of all the counts. Chavis was a juvenile at the time, several months under 18. So he got as much, he got convicted, and he got as large a sentence as he, as a juvenile at the time could get. So that's difficult to say. What is clear is that Robert Bethel put that on the precipice. Had Robert Bethel testified as the state
expected. But you had a good case anyway.
Well, apparently good enough. You know, with that 12 people, apparently the jury decided to convict. It's not entirely clear from reading the appellate opinion how the testimony was identical or similar between the Chavis case and the Bethel case. Obviously, it was the same crime. But the defendant is the one that put that on the precipice, and I don't think that one of the cases that I've cited talks about that.
So he got an awfully good deal, didn't he, when you offered this, because the other defendant's a juvenile, wasn't going to get death anyway.
Right.
Right. Right. And you took death off the table for him with this plea agreement. So essentially you took death off the table for something that wasn't all that important to the state to begin with.
Oh, I can't agree with the court's position there. I think that any double murder case, a double homicide case, is important to the state. I don't think that anybody, neither the appellant nor the appellee, is suggesting that this case is something less than incredibly important. Certainly important to the people involved, the defendants, and certainly important to the people left behind. I think that the Scruggs case that I've cited in my brief, United States versus Scruggs, I think it's erroneously cited as State versus Scruggs, but the citation's correct, talked about that. The defendant wanted to make a point in his appellate, in the appellate argument, and said, well, look, my agreement with you wasn't really all that important anyway. As a matter of fact, in that case, you guys, you the state or the federal government, you convicted my co-defendant anyway. And the Court of Appeals, as I said, for the Fourth Circuit, said, that's not important. We're not going to leave it to the defendant in a case like this to decide how important his agreement and his cooperation with the state are. What's important is the reasonable expectation that the state had at the time they made the agreement.
It is the ultimate high-stakes poker, isn't it? I mean, you testify, you don't lose your life. You don't testify, you're subject to death.
I think that simply because you put a defendant in a position of saying, a defendant who committed the murder, by the way, if we put this fellow in the position of saying, if you cooperate with us so that we can be assured that we are going to convict both responsible people, we're not going to give you the death penalty. It's an awkward position. It's a soul-searching position for a defendant, but it's not an unconstitutional one.
I understand that. I'm just probing what seems to me to be
the oddity that we do see in this plea bargaining effort that goes on, that between the two, how would you rank them in terms of menace to society, culpability in this particular event?
I don't know the answer to that, because the only person that testified about what actually happened at the scene is the person who committed the crimes. And it seems like he was minimizing his culpability when he told his girlfriend, Teresa Cobb, what he did. I don't know how he told his friend, the snitch, Donald Langbein. I don't know how he phrased it, but when he talked to the police, he, Robert Bethel, tried to put more of the emphasis on Jeremy Chavis's role, said that was his idea. Jeremy Chavis was really Tyrone Green's buddy. But what's clear is we have two shooters.
Well, this is a very serious case, isn't it? I mean, Reynolds was going to testify in a killing, and he was a witness in unsolved murders, and he was shot 10 times. And a 14-year-old girl, his girlfriend, was also killed? This is a very serious matter. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, it was unsolved, and now we're moving toward a resolution. So this had high importance to the state of Ohio, did it not?
Well, Bethel didn't get convicted until 4 years after these murders occurred.
Right.
Chavis had gotten convicted at least a year before that. I don't know the date of his appellate opinion at this point. Having said that, and now that we know that these two people have been called to for their actions, maybe an ultimate problem, the ultimate impact on this is on the Tyrone Green case. Now he is the person for whom the prosecutor was left with a failure of proof. He is, all of this, I should back up, all of this was committed, it is the state's position, because the appellant and his buddy were allied with Tyrone Green, Tyrone Green being ready to stand trial for the Rodney Cain trial. Rodney Cain's prosecution was left with a failure of proof when Reynolds was killed. The state took a plea to some sort of manslaughter. It was not the murder that was charged. So maybe that's an indirect impact. Maybe that's an indirect way of answering your question.
So the failure to cooperate impacted that case as well, or not?
That's difficult to say. I don't think that Robert Bethel was ever tagged to be a witness in the Tyrone Green case.
Okay. So no. I guess what I'm probing is the curiosity of offering this man a way out at all.
Well, without knowing what was going on in the background of the Chavis trial, it's clear that the prosecution thought they needed the Robert Bethel testimony. In reading the Chavis opinion, it's clear that they relied on two snitches in that case, Langbein from this case, and then someone else. So, but I think the Scruggs case is very instructive, and it cites another case. Scruggs, in turn, cites United States versus Kelly for the proposition that...
Well, counsel, I may have taken you far afield. I'm just probing the thought process of the prosecutors. You're getting low on time, and you haven't addressed the closing of the courtroom.
Okay. To close that off, it's our position that the defendant's subjective beliefs about what the nature of his cooperation is totally irrelevant here, and I encourage the court to consider Scruggs' case in regard to that. Well, it's our position with regard to the open courtroom that this is not a plain error. It's our position that the Cassano and Bayless cases together lead us to the conclusion that a courtroom that is closed for the benefit of and with the consent of the defendant.
Well, what about structural error and noncompliance with the Weller versus Georgia case?
Weller versus Georgia was an extreme example. A 7-day suppression hearing was closed to the public in that case. I think that that's
well,
been
does it really matter whether it's a 1-day closure or a 7-day closure?
I believe it does, and I believe it's the case that's important to our to my understanding of that is Douglas versus Wainwright. Douglas versus Wainwright said they distinguished it was contemporary with the Waller versus Georgia case. They were within a year of each other, I believe. What's significant is that Douglas versus Wainwright contrasted a completely closed courtroom to a partially closed courtroom, or more appropriately, a courtroom that's closed for part of the proceedings versus a courtroom that's closed for all of the proceedings. In that case, they said that you only need a substantial, not a compelling interest. And the question that has to be asked of the court is, did the defendant still get the safeguards of a public trial? An additional distinction, Your Honor, that I would bring between the Waller situation and this situation is answered in the Cianfrani case, U.S. versus Cianfrani. And that talks about adjudicative proceedings. There are two cases, an Ohio case and Cianfrani suggests to the court that adjudicative proceedings, which evidence is called, is different than one in which preliminary matters are discussed. Are there any other questions? It's our position that the trial should be affirmed and the sentence should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tamulin. Mr. Clark, you've saved 3.5 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to address, I think, 3 points that apparently came up here in the state's argument. First, I want to address the question of, in ranking, the culpability of Mr. Bethel's co-defendant. I think if I'm wrong, don't recall any other case where the death-eligible defendant had death taken off the table to testify against somebody who was not death-eligible. And if that doesn't give you an idea of the way the prosecutors viewed the ranking of culpability,
legally, that really doesn't make any difference. I raise it as a matter of public interest.
I agree with you, but I think
from a legal standpoint, it doesn't help your client at all, does it?
Legally, no, but I think an additional matter of public interest is, and I raised this in one of the other issues that we've not addressed here today, but it's in the brief. I think when you look at the reason that Bobby Bethel was ultimately tried and the death penalty was asked for by the prosecutor as the only appropriate punishment, and you think about the absurdity of that when they're willing to take death off the table to have him testify against a juvenile, non-death eligible, and I think from a defense perspective, hurting their case more by now having the co-defendant come in, and the first part of the first chapter of that cross-examination is going to be, well, Mr. Bethel, isn't it true you're here because you saved your life? That's the only reason you're here? So I think it hurts the state's case by having Bobby Bethel testify in the Chavez case. I think to show you how overwhelming the evidence was in the Chavez case, look at the Court of Appeals decision in that case, which is cited in the brief. And in that, the 10th District Court of Appeals said the introduction of the gang affiliation photographs was improper, but it's harmless because it was so overwhelming the guilt they had that we don't have to reverse that conviction. And that gives you an idea of how strong that case was. The other issue I want to try to respond to, and I think I have a couple minutes for this, is a closed courtroom. I think one of the things that is critical here is reading Rule 11 in conjunction with, I think it's Docket Exhibit 84, which was a media request to cover these proceedings. The media was shut out of this plea hearing. It's my understanding there's a case on the docket for you today that talks about media's access to records. So this case obviously had a great public interest. There's a negotiated plea in it. And to exclude them without making the findings of fact that this court has approved and endorsed in Cassano, You adopted the Supreme Court language that requires, under the First Amendment, a preliminary hearing could not be closed, even at the defendant's request, unless specific on-the-record findings demonstrate that closure is essential to preserve higher values and is narrowly tailored to serve that interest. And I think when you go back and look at the record again, you'll see that that is not, you can't find anything in the record that will meet that test. The trial court just didn't do it.
Is the appropriate sanction for failing to comply with that standard reversal?
I think my long answer to your question is yes, with the understanding that whatever happened at that proceeding that was not properly conducted is it basically treated as though it never existed. So there, the plea, in our fact specific, the plea agreement that was reviewed during the closed proceeding, that agreement doesn't exist. It can't be used by the state or the defense, either affirmatively or defensively, under any circumstances, like it never happened. And I don't know any other remedy that you could have on this odd procedural fact, unfortunately.
So that's your response to Waller not applying. Waller, as we said before, Waller says that the remedy is not a reversal, but the remedy is to have another suppression hearing. That doesn't work here because why?
Because we've got past the plea that was set aside at the state's request. And so I think he's entitled to have whatever happened at hearing not used against him. And in the other proposition we didn't address under Evidence Rule 410, even if the proffer is admissible and you disagree with my arguments about the proffer, the fact that there was a plea entered, that it was withdrawn, and the reason for its withdrawal, as the prosecutor alluded to in his argument here, was all admitted in evidence through Detective Calley, through the state. That's all as a result of that Rule 11 closed-door proceeding that the media was denied access to.
Well, in reality, then, there would have to be a new trial, wouldn't there?
In reality, yes. And I think the specific prayer that I put with the proposition is that it would be a new trial with the specific understanding that whatever happened there would not be admitted. That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.